No one plans for hair loss, but through Hims, you can take the next step with confidence. Access treatments made with clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil to stop hair loss and regrow hair in 3 to 6 months. No waiting rooms, no hoops, just ingredients with a track record of results. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you, with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put your goals first. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your free online visit. hims.com/Hail Mary. Individual results may vary, based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're back for part two of our discussion of the offense and that heartbreaking loss to the Patriots, which has all but eliminated the Ravens' playoff hopes for the year. Joining me to talk about the offense in some more detail is Matt Roth. Matt, how you doing?
Doing good, Ken. Looking forward to getting to the offensive line here.
So we talked a lot of the first show about a variety of things. Let's just remind people what those were so they'll go back and listen to the episode if they haven't already. We spent a lot of time talking about how difficult a day it was. Hopefully you'll live through us on that, because I know you lived through it as well in terms of the Steelers winning their game in unbelievable fashion, the Ravens losing to the Patriots, and then Lamar Jackson getting hurt. A lot of the kind of a fall off a cliff nature of Sunday was in the fact that Lamar had played so well for a lot of that first half, and particularly on that first drive, that there was a lot of hope, not only for this game, but for the rest of the season as well.
Yeah, for sure. And that hope evaporated as we saw a lot of the same demons come back with the, false starts, the fumbles, the poor defensive play. Did have more pressure than we've seen in a while, it seemed like. But ultimately, the Ravens couldn't hit it. So we talked about a lot of the frustration, which I'm sure you all will feel. So if you didn't catch it, go back and check that first episode, and I think you guys will like it. But moving on into the offensive line, the quarterbacks, Lamar and Huntley, they took one sack. The offensive line allowed four pressures, three quarterback hits as a group. There were only 21 pass plays, which is certainly on the lower side, and there were two false start flags. So that's kind of the overall summary, Ken. Why don't you start us off with Stanley on the left side? He had a really good game. It's great to see Ronnie playing well, especially towards the end of the year where injuries have mounted in the past. How did he do in this game?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, he's played very well in since week eight, since the bye. He's come back and he's played very well at really like kind of a B-minus, C-plus level. Mm-hmm. I think we could have realistically assumed that for $20 million a year, they were going to get a C-level player. A lot of other teams wanted to sign him for a contract that would have been $4 or $5 million more, I think, than the Ravens would have paid. He gave the Ravens, I think, a hometown discount. He certainly gave them a quality first year of his contract. And you know, the fact that he's playing well in the second half is now leading me to believe, you know, that he's got a good chance to play well next year as well. But I'll go through his play quickly in this game. 53 plays, 49 blocks. He missed three blocks the whole game, only allowed one pressure the entire game. And it was a kind of a Stanley special where he basically was backed into the cone very, very tight to, I believe it was Huntley, right, after the second half. Go back and confirm that. It did happen toward, the first drive of quarter three, he got bowled by Chase on back into basically Huntley's face, so such that he had to move. That's a type of pressure. I've talked about this a lot before, bump pressure, where Lamar is very comfortable working with that. And it's been a great synergy between these two players, is that a lot of the pressures that he gives up have been of that type, which have allowed him to move and get clear and still make a throw out of that. He did have a false start in the game, 0.85 per play after you total up his points. With adjustment, that's an A. He did have seven blocks in level two, made three of his four pulls, had three highlight blocks. And the highlight block I want to point out was just a thoroughly amazing play. It was on the touchdown run by Flowers, the 18-yard run to the right side. Remember, that ball is run to the right side. Normally, he's left behind unblocked, without a dance partner on that side of the line. You can't really do much with a down block the guy next to you. So he has to run hard into level two to try and find somebody and cut off either a linebacker who maybe went astray or even a corner or a safety that's further downfield. He went all the way to the right sideline to block number 31. I don't know who that is offhand without looking at the Patriots roster. But he blocked him towards the sideline. It was a kickout block on towards the sideline all the way from left tackle. That was the big block at the end of that run by Flowers that cleared him up. Just an amazingly athletic thing. And it's what we've seen from Stanley his whole career. It's the kind of career highlight reel block you'd want to have that there. And Stanley has plenty of those where he blocks two guys on a play. I think he's been one of the guys who's blocked three guys on a play with getting just really good push that takes them, retracts players that are oftentimes smaller than him. But that block, just a thing of beauty that ended up springing Flowers for the touchdown there.
Now, Ken, did he leave early and Vincent came in to play the last few snaps?
Not that I'm aware of. Let me check that and make sure that's true. No, he played all the snaps.
Okay. that's what I thought. I was just confirming. Scared me a little bit when I saw that there. He's not on the injury report, so all good there. I think that it's hard to overstate the importance of Ronnie Stanley to this team next year. Don't know how much longer he'll be playing, but having him play well at the end of this year is really important. And Just really happy to see this performance from him.
So the Ravens are going to next year, and you make an excellent point here that it's an important position that for the last N years, they've needed another tackle. I'm not saying they can't go out and sign a backup swing guy, but you know, whatever, but incredibly the Ravens have three tackles now that I'd feel very comfortable heading directly into camp with.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And so many other positions, they are positions of need now in the draft, whether it's for the next guy, for the last guy, or for a starter in a lot of cases with all the free agents they have leaving.
Yeah. All right. So great to hear that Stanley played well. Voorhees didn't play very well. Take us through, Andrew.
No, it's a terrible game. 40 plays, 28 blocks, missed seven. So that's a lot of missed blocks for only 40 plays. He left early, as you may or may not have realized, with some sort of foot injury. He's back limited at practice today. But he gave up 1.5 pressures. He gave up two quarterback hits in the game. It's kind of a rare game where you give up two full quarterback hits in a game. And then I charged him for 2/3 of the sack. I charged Falele with the other 1/3 of it. They were both kind of getting beat, but the reason Falele got beat was he got tripped up by Voorhees on the play. And so I thought that one was about 2/3 of Voorhees' responsibility. And then that was only 15 total points, 0.38 per play. So with adjustment, he's at 0.41, which is an F by at guard by 26 points. So when you talk about a fall off the table game for a guard, this was it. This is by far his worst game of the year. Probably the worst game of his career. I'd have to look back to last year to see if he had anything that was like this, but a very tough game. 5 level 2 blocks, 2 pancakes. Now, one of the things you probably heard me talking about this year is how well Voorhees has been doing with pulling. Mm-hmm. And so he went 4-for-6 in pulls early in the game, and then he had a minus 3 for allowing a quarterback hit that occurred on his next to last play of the game. So I don't know if he was hurt at that point or not, or whether he might have been hurt on this play, but he got spun around. He got compressed into space and then spun around, and he saw an opportunity to jump outside Ronnie Stanley and make a block in the C gap to try and hold up the pocket. And he got there in time. He just couldn't hold up the block and got failed to pick up Chaisson, who came in and got the quarterback hit. So bummer of a situation there for Voorhees. I hope the injury is not severe. He is a guy I know a lot of people have already given up on him, and they want, you know, first of all, you hope your problem is of a transient nature and it could be fixed by a couple of draft picks or a timely free agent acquisition or one of each. But the fact of the matter is Voorhees probably is in the Ravens' plans regardless for next year. He's got 2 years of team control left at very cheap salary. The Ravens don't give up on such players. And frankly, he's improved enough this year that I think there would be reason to try and use that additional runway they still have with him. They're in a relatively good position with him relative to Emory Jones in one respect. Emory Jones didn't take an NFI year this year. I don't know if the Ravens discussed it with him, but they didn't go that route. They did go that route with Voorhees, and it means he's still got 2 years left to try and improve his play before he hits free agency. And the Ravens will take advantage of that and make progress. Emory Jones did come in for him at the end of the game. And unfortunately, I was asked the question earlier today, is he a reasonable alternative? First of all, I'm sorry. Let's you opine here on Voorhees for a second. Expect him back with the 26 Ravens?
Yeah, so I certainly, I mean, I don't see why he wouldn't be back. You got him for 2 more years. I'm fairly certain he's going to be on the team. Does that mean he's going to be starting in 26 and 27? I don't know. I think that's up in the air. I think, like you said, I think there's going to be some changes after this season. I don't know how big. I don't know if it goes all the way up to the top of the coaching staff, but there's definitely going to be changes. But there's no reason why he couldn't be a backup on the team. Right. And, you know, he's got 2 years left. Hopefully he's getting better. You have to wonder, did he tweak his foot earlier in the game and he was trying to fight through it? But, you know, it's kind of strange to see a fall off the table game because I don't think he's had many this year. I'm not saying he's been great. He's certainly had some performances that weren't good. But, you know, as you always say, there's a difference between I took my algebra test and I got a D versus I took my algebra test and I've got, you know, at 20% of the test correct, right? They're just completely different stratospheres, and it's definitely a bummer to see him have this fall off the table game here.
So he had 2 Fs previously in the season. Week 2 against Cleveland, he got a net of 61, an adjusted 61, 6 points short of passing. And then he had a 57 versus Minnesota where he lost his whole adjustment for some reason. I don't remember what it was. Might have been he was run out of pressure, might have been he messed up something else, but he was 10 points short of passing in this game. This game was 26 points short of passing. So in a different ballpark in terms of what's going on here. So tough game for Andrew, and hopefully he recovers and is still able to play. Let's talk about Emory Jones a little bit before we go on to the other line, you know, the other players from center to the right. But he came in and he had a lot of trouble. Harbaugh is trying to be nice to him at the podium. That's what he does with all players and tries to pick out the positives. Not, you don't want to run the player over with the truck in both directions. But he said, you know, he's a young player. He looked like a gifted player. There's some snaps he wants to have back. Everybody wants those. That's absolutely true of offensive line play. Nobody ever has a clean sheet in offensive line play in a 60 or 65 play game. You go through it. You don't have, you know, no problems. There's a lot of notations and the sheet gets dirtier and dirtier depending on how tough the game is for various players. But he missed 3 blocks out of 13. He also had a half a quarterback hit he gave up. And one of his other missed blocks was a pressure that Huntley ran him out of. So if it was PFF, they'd probably give him a pressure on that play. And he might have had 2 pressures from PFF or might have had a quarterback hit and a pressure from PFF. I'm not sure what it would have been. but he probably would have shown up with two events on his scorecard for that, because he got run out of him once. I adjust for it differently, but his points per play were only at 0.58. So even with he would have lost his entire adjustment, certainly, for giving up one run out of pressure in the few snaps he played. So, you know, he was 9 points below the Mendoza line, if you want to call it that. He was 9 points, you know, failing. So that didn't work out either for the Ravens. So I was asked the question, is Emory Jones right now a better player than Andrew Voorhees? My answer is a firm no at this point. I know there are people who are going to disagree with that. You got to come to the table with more than just, I saw him make this one play.
I mean, I think it has to be a no. And frankly, if I'm thinking of what expectation is, you have a rookie coming off of shoulder surgery who missed training camp, preseason, the first 8 or 9 weeks. I mean, I think that it's I'm glad he's getting some snaps now. I'm not sure how much I can use those snaps to say, do we need this type of player or that type of player in the offseason? I think I'm at the point where you want the offensive line to be as good as it can be. I don't know if you really want to pencil Emory in as a starter. If he wins a starting job, right, and you maybe sign, say you lose Linderbaum and you lose Fa'alele, right? Maybe you sign a veteran guard center and you draft a guard center, and then you have Corey Bullock, right? Maybe you add one more person too, right? Because you're losing Cleveland. Mm-hmm. I could see that working, and it's kind of a dogfight between Voorhees, Emory Jones, the vet that you sign, maybe a third round or a second round draft pick that you have, and you really need to figure out what's the best combination. I don't know if I'm willing to lock Voorhees or Emory Jones into starter roles, but you know, I think they'll be there, and it's Emory's got to get some positional coaching in the offseason. He's got to get bigger, faster, stronger. He's got to heal up. And I think there are starting jobs on this line for him to take, but he's really got to take it. And frankly, it shouldn't be given to him. They've got to bring in some competition.
So the only thing I'll take a little bit of the other side of the coin on that is that I think that it would have been better, not necessarily for Emory Jones, though I think the Ravens and Emory Jones could have come to an agreement, but it would have been better for him to sit out the whole year on NFI.
Yeah.
And it clearly, in a year where the Ravens haven't gone anywhere and Jones has not earned a starting spot in a guard tandem that includes Voorhees and Fa'alele, who are two guys, whether or not you believe they ought to be replaced this year, they're vulnerable to being replaced by the right player. If you had the right player, you know, that was sitting there ready to go in the background, I think Harbaugh has been kind of frustrated by this question. Is he's basically saying, we don't have anybody better right now. Is what the subtext of what he's saying is, then, you know, obviously it wasn't worth him playing this year. Now, the downside to it would have been, instead of getting some practice snaps and some practice reps this year, he wouldn't have been able to do anything but classroom work, I believe, with the team. Mm-hmm. And then that would have meant that he was behind in terms of where he started from next year. He would have started with positional coaching and whatnot during the offseason and hopefully had a very productive time that would lead up to, you know, a chance to win a starting job next year. But you know, this is a lost year for Emory Jones, and it's a lost year on the starting contract of a third round draft pick, which is a very, very high cost for the Baltimore Ravens. So I don't think there's any way I can play nice with this and say it was a good thing that he got these snaps in any kind of relative sense this year. It's a bad thing that he got.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think it's a very bad thing for the organization. But you know, maybe if Voorhees has a foot injury, maybe he can get some snaps upcoming for the last two games. I'm trying to make a wine out of water here.
Lemon out of lemonade. Yeah,
I'm not feeling that great about it. Voorhees practiced on Tuesday. He was limited with the foot injury. But yeah, I mean, I would rather had him NFI'd. I think it sucks that he wasn't, but I don't know. Maybe he can get a game or two of snaps and that helps in the future. I do think it is very hard for rookies to be productive. And so, you know, like people are looking at this upcoming rookie class that we draft and look, it can turn the whole franchise around, but that doesn't mean that next year the impact of the rookies is going to be all that high. I actually think we're probably getting the highest impact from a rookie crop that you could really expect this year, from Green to Starks to Buchanan to Keon Martin, right? I just don't know how much more you can really expect from a crop of rookies.
Yeah, I mean, they have gotten a fairly good impact. And what's better is not necessarily the impact they got this year. It's the impact they're going to get next year from those players. And we certainly hope Malachi Starks takes the next step forward next year, for example. Green, I think he's right on track for that. Mm-hmm. Malachi Starks, I'm a little bit worried about, frankly, with his rookie year being what it is. He's actually lost snaps as the season has gone on, which is not something you would expect. And he's giving up a lot of yards per target, which was the central fear for him coming out of college. You know, this is there's always a groupthink that goes along with a lot of the draft process that I try not to becoming part of. Let's move on here. I don't want to get this into another what the draft could have been talk here, which
won't do that, Ken. I won't get you stirred up this late at night. All right, let's move on to Linderbaum. So Linderbaum was getting a lot of love from the
Wasn't he?
I would say Linderbaum, if you were just casually watching and you like running the ball, he is one of the sexiest run blockers you'll see. His mobility is incredible. And he's gripping. I mean, I remember a play from last year or 2 years ago where he's running all the way down the field, making a block. I mean, going at the same pace as the running back or the receiver who had the ball. He's super sexy from a run blocking perspective. And he got a lot of love for it. However, if you look at his grade, right, which you graded him at a C, it's not all about the sexy run blocks. And oh, by the way, pass blocking is more important than run blocking. So what'd you think, Ken?
Well, you've nailed all the key points there. And he did very well as a run block. We'll get to that in just a second. In terms of a pass blocking, he missed six blocks, which is a fair amount to miss in 53 snaps. So that's and a lot of that was at the line of scrimmage losses, where one of them came on Henry's fumble, where he's beaten left by Tonga, for example. He got stood up and shed on a 1 yard run. It was about three plays later than that. So a lot of it was at the line of scrimmage kind of stuff. Then Collinsworth gave him a lot of love in terms of what he'd done during the game and the way he'd moved around. I think it's a matter of they had video of him. They were probably looking at some interim PFF grades from the game and trying to find out who's a player that we can point to that is really good. And he did have his big negative event came late in the game when he allowed a quarterback hit. He was bowled directly into Huntley by Gibbons, I believe. And it's a rare play where he gets bowled directly and knocks down Huntley himself. Mm-hmm. So it's an unusual one, but it's not a question of who was responsible for it. He's the first one there, and he hit the ground directly off the contact from Linderbaum. So that was all him. And then it was a shared pressure he had earlier in the game where he – weird play, a lot of things going on the play, but he tried to do too much and ended up doing not anything pretty much on the play. So he tried to help out the left guard who was losing his block, and in the process he managed to lose his own block and not take a handoff from Fa'alele, which he would have appropriately taken. So he ended up also getting driven back into the quarterback at the same time. Half a pressure was all it was, which is remarkable that Lamar was able to hold the damage to that, but that's what happened. And here's the good part. Now, on the run blocking side, he had 9 level 2 blocks in this game. That's a ridiculous number. He had 5 pancakes. Now, the guys who normally get pancakes, Voorhees is a good pancake guy. Fa'alele has been very good with pancakes recently, although that generally my problem with him is he doesn't get nearly enough for what his size is. He doesn't finish. Rosengarten and Stanley pick up pancakes at a reasonable pace. But for Linderbaum to have 5 in a game, I mean, he's probably the least likely guy to deliver a pancake. And he moved around violently in level 2. Delivering some of those hits, including a hit to, I think it was Durden early in the game. I don't think it was Barmore. I think it was Durden early in the game, who's a bigger man. And he knocked him right down onto the ground in level 2 hard as the whistle was getting blown. And that was a nice, you know, echo with a whistle, kind of a finish your block in level 2 play that I like to see from Tyler. He was part of 3 different pulls. Each of those times was part of a counter play. He hit on all 3 of his pulls. He had 3 highlight blocks, including the one I mentioned on the violent back end block. There are lots of really positives in terms of what Linderbaum did, but the game is also the archetype for what he's done his whole career, basically, in terms of being an outstanding run blocker and a pass blocker that is still in search of improvement there to try and become a better lineman overall. And, you know, we look at some of the younger centers in the league, and in particular in the division, Zach Frazier is just ahead of him at this point by a substantial amount in terms of his level of play. And Linderbaum is, you know, a slightly below average pass blocker for a center. And frankly, that's involved some improvement for the year. So we'll see. In the last couple of weeks, I've been upping my number that I'd be willing to pay Linderbaum for multiple reasons. One thing I've been saying is that the Ravens need to have some of the glue to hold the line together from a run blocking perspective. They have a chance to go out and get the guards they need in the draft. In fact, if they drafted a guard in round two and round three and signed Linderbaum kind of thing, it would be an over expenditure on the offensive line. And I'm not even sure I'd be that upset about it. They'd be running back a lot of the skill position players they had. They'd be the big thing that they might be not handling properly is either another corner, which that group is getting very old right now, or another pass rusher, because they can only draft one of those in round one if they draft a guard in rounds two and three. So they're going to have to be careful about how they allocate their picks. But if that's what they ended up doing and they got the guys they really liked in those rounds, I wouldn't mind having Linderbaum back, because I think you can then put together a good offensive line with that group. But Linderbaum, you know, we talk about the guards are not helping Linderbaum at all. That's not the way to look at this problem. Linderbaum has pass blocking deficiencies of his own that need to be solved. So in a sense, the guards have to make up for Linderbaum, not the other way around. Linderbaum is the non-performer in this group that we know is going to be at that level, particularly if we pay him as a pass blocker. They're going to need to find another way to find additional pass blocking quality, or find a unit that can work together extraordinarily well with pass blocking skills that are fairly average. And you look at this at the Ravens team, one thing they've had on the offensive line these last two seasons is incredible continuity along the offensive line. They've had very few injuries they've really had to deal with that have caused players to miss multiple games here. Miss a game or two. Yeah, there's been some of that. You'll find that across the league all the time. But take a look at the Chargers. You know, they're down to what, their seventh left tackle or something right now. I mean, they've gone through a huge number of offensive tackles. The Steelers are, you know, down to Dylan Cook at left tackle right now. And the Bengals have been through all kinds of players. You know, the Patriots have lost their first round draft pick. I mean, the Ravens actually have been very fortunate in terms of injury luck, and the offensive line has not played terribly on the year. They've been okay as a unit, and it's easy to beat up on the guards themselves, but the unit as a whole has been okay. And they've really benefited from this continuity. But anyway, I'd like to hear your thoughts on how you would like the Ravens to proceed this year. First of all, start for me with this. How much are you willing to pay Linderbaum on a 4-year basis in terms of AAV?
Yeah, I think I might be significantly lower than most. I'm having a hard time going higher than 12 or 13 million AAV. I think Tyler, again, explosive run blocker, but I think he's below average as a pass blocker. I think he's small, both short arms and light. I think he plays around 300 pounds. I would love someone who is more the 320, 322, 325 pound mold. And I think you can get away with someone cheaper there. And I'm just, I mean, they just blew their load on Andrews. Again, I'm still a bit frustrated by it. Love Andrews as a player. Would love to have Andrews back. I can't see any sense in $13 million a year with the way that he is trending and the way that the team utilizes him. But yeah, I could do four years, $12.5 million per year. But I think I would like to see better pass blocking from the center position.
Okay. So I don't think that would come close to getting it done.
I don't think so either.
We've heard that the Ravens and Linderbaum have a very big chasm between them in terms of what the offer is. I don't even have a problem that the Ravens say, hey, look, we know this might not be enough, but take this to the market, see what you can get. If you can't do any better, we'll come back and we'll sign you for this. I wouldn't mind if that number were around 14.5 million, 15 million. If it's a look, we don't want to send you empty-handed to the market. We want you to A, maximize your comp value within the formula. So we don't just signing for a crap contract. And I think that's kind of what happened to Patrick Queen, by the way. is that he just, there weren't a lot of bidders out there for Patrick Queen, and the Ravens didn't put in a bid, as far as I know, in terms of something that would be a support level for Patrick Queen. He thought he was going to make, you know, 4 years, $70 million, and he ends up making 3 years, $40 million with the Steelers. So a $13 million AAV instead of, you know, 17 and a half. And that obviously was, you know, was frustrating to him, and he's played up to that contract exactly. So, or less. But anyway, with Linderbaum, they need to try and give him something that he can go to the market with. And then it's also, in the old Aussie world, it was always something that you know, was a fence mender with your players who might be back, whether they're back right away or whether they're back at some point later, as they've had with some linemen. Orlando Brown comes to mind as a guy who had two tours with the Ravens, I believe. You know, it helps, you know, to have that player back at a later point. So,
yeah, I would offer him a contract, but it would be 4 for $50, 4 for $48, somewhere around there.
Okay,
and I would think that he's going to come in. I mean, you saw how much who Green was Humphrey? The left guard who had a penalty every other snap that the Ravens had, who went to the Jets.
Oh, John Simpson. Yeah.
Simpson. You saw how much he got, right?
Right.
I mean, I would think that someone's going to offer Linderbaum 18 and a half, 19.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be a bridge too far, but I wouldn't want to treat him poorly. He's a good player. I'm happy he was here. But I'm looking to change a little bit about how this offensive line is built. And I really don't believe on spending money on centers unless you have Creed Humphrey. So right now, if I look at the centers in the league, it's kind of Creed Humphrey or bust. I would rather them put the money elsewhere. We need more pass rush. We need, whether it's defensive tackle or edge, we need more. And we can't go into next year with the same pass rush plan. And I would just rather money be spent there.
Well, whoever is the head coach, And you know, I assume Eric DaCosta, need to really sell the notion to Steve Bisciotti that they need to spend the non-cap dollars to acquire outstanding position coaches. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that might be John Harbaugh. It might not be. Let's face it. It's certainly a possibility at this point. John's not going to be back. But whoever it is, position coaches are the gold. They're your coaching talent tree that you can prospect from and grow your next coordinators from, and eventually grow your next head coach from if your current guy isn't working out.
I agree with you. Where are you on the Linderbaum? You're willing to offer a little bit more?
I think I would go up to $17 million. I think the trick in here is to try and make it $17 million over 3 years, limit liability on the deal, which is bad. If you're going to pay that much for a center, it better be because you think you're getting value at the position. You want to make it as long as possible, not as short as possible. But if it was 3 years for 50 or $51 million, I think I'd be okay with that at this point. He'd improve, by the way, and he's in a better position relative to all the centers in the league as a pass blocker. Had Timo Riska came out with the thing, which also uses PFF grading, but it looks at pass blocking difficulty by situation, and his situations, which involve an N factor model of down and distance and who the opponent is and things like that, showed that he'd had a above average difficulty level for his situation, that on an adjusted basis, he was above the line in terms of being above average as a pass blocker on an adjusted basis again. That being the case, I'd go a little bit more, but I can't pay him more than Creed Humphrey makes. And it means that the offer relative to Cam Jurgens, say, is not going to seem to make sense. It's unfortunate that the Steelers went into a season and they got exactly the player they needed in Zach Frazier, who's now looking like he's headed to multiple Pro Bowls probably from this point forward. And they've now done it for what, three times now with great centers who might be headed on to even the Hall of Fame at some point. Not sure. It's too early for Zach Frazier to say that, but it wasn't for DeMonte Dawson or Larry Webster. They're already there. So, you know, it is for a player like Zach Frazier is in the right position for the right team out of the right circumstances to do very well in that situation. And, you know, honestly, the biggest thing the Ravens need to spend on this year is an offensive line coach. I think they need to find the next great dynastic coach, because even if you like some of the things Warhop has done, I think it's only fair to recognize that he's the guy who pounded the table for Carson Vinson. That could really pay off for the Ravens. And he's also a guy who reduced penalties in the latter part of 24, and it's basically hung with the team in 25 that they haven't been highly penalized. So that part of their game, at least, has been good. If you look at those two things, I look at the value of that coach as being his value now plus the present value of all the increments he gives you over the future, over the average coach at that position in the league in the future. And the problem is that he just can't coach for that much longer. Warhop is 65 years old now. I mean, I just can't project that you're getting any value from that 5, 6, 7, 8 years from now. And you can't with a player, you can't ever do that. But offensive line coaches, they don't typically ascend to be offensive coordinators. So it's usually a position that it stays the same. So it's the position you really want to have the right coach there. And if the Ravens go to the market and they try and find that guy from the college ranks, like, there's no sexier job out there. You know, so whoever's the best, you know, 38 to 45 year old coach of the offensive line that's out there in the college ranks, bring him here to Baltimore, pay him what he needs to be paid, and make him the next superstar of the NFL in the coaching ranks.
Yeah, agreed completely. I would also like to get a little bit different size and shape on the line. Mm-hmm. I don't like having a player as big as Falele. I think you get limited in what you can do from a quick twitch perspective, and you find yourself confused in space because you just can't react quick enough. I think it's actually hard when you're that big. And then Linderbaum, I think he's just a little too small. And so I don't like having the pairing of someone who's too big and too small next to each other. I don't mind alternating big, small. I think there's effective ways to do it, but I don't love the combination that they have now. All right. So let's move into Falele. Go again.
All right, so we probably need to pick up the pace a little bit here. I'll just be real quickly. So sure. Falele had, if you're trying to make Falele memes this week, or you're trying to pick out plays that Falele, you won't have any problem. There's tons of them where he's very indecisive in level two. One thing I'll warn you about is, you know, this kind of foolishness and his indecisiveness isn't super costly on run plays. So you have to find the pass plays where he really fails to do it. And he had a good pass blocking game here. Let's go through it. He missed 9 blocks, though. A lot of that was indecision, a lot of L2NBs, some ZNBs, some other plays that were not perfect. He missed 2 pulls as well. But he gave up 1/3 of a sack, kind of a difficult situation where he tripped over Voorhees, who had allowed the initial pressure. I gave Voorhees 2/3 of that sack, but Falele was getting beat.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
No one plans for hair loss, but through Hims, you can take the next step with confidence. Access treatments made with clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil to stop hair loss and regrow hair in 3 to 6 months. No waiting rooms, no hoops, just ingredients with a track record of results. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you, with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put your goals first. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit Hims.com/Hail Mary. That's Hims.com/Hail Mary for your free online visit. Hims.com/Hail Mary. Individual results may vary, based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
This is Michael Rosenbaum.
Hey, folks, let me tell you that drinking and driving is a decision that will change your whole world. Things will never be the same once you get a DUI, because legal fees and time in court are just the beginning. Getting into a crash is another way your world could be irreversibly changed after drinking and driving. Your vehicle may not be the only thing that gets damaged in that crash. You could face a life-altering injury or even death. But you're not the only one who could face those consequences. Your decision to drink and drive could permanently change someone else's world, whether you injure them or leave their loved ones grieving. The next time you're out drinking, call a rideshare, a taxi, a sober friend, or a designated sober driver. Always plan for a safe ride home. The only decision that will change your world for the better is the decision to call for a sober ride. It's never worth it to drive drunk. Don't risk it. Drive sober. Or get pulled over, paid for by NHTSA.
On the play, he deserved at least the equivalent of a pressure, so that's what I gave him on the play, was one-third of that sack, which is exactly what he would have gotten in terms of a negative score on a pressure as well. That was his only negative event for the game. He wasn't penalized, didn't have any other negative pass rush events, so a good game from him otherwise. 41 points, 0.77 per play with a small adjustment. He's at 0.80 overall, which is in the middle of the C range. I've had five level two blocks. We have been seeing a little bit better run blocking from Daniel. He had a very nice push of Mitchell to get the first down. Mitchell ran for 5, 3, and 2 on three consecutive plays, which is exactly the 10 yards, of course, needed. And he got the last 14 to 18 inches of that, we'll say, from a push from Daniel Falele to make that a first down there, which was nice. So anyway, he had his pluses and minuses in this game. That was his highlight block, as I saw it, though, the push on Mitchell.
How about Rosengarten? How did he score for you?
So good. So Rosengarten had 53 plays, made all but 9 of his blocks. 7 of those were misses. Then he allowed 1 pressure. So it's a really nice game when your 2 offensive tackles only have 1 pressure allowed. That was only 21 pass snaps, but even if you double that to kind of what it would be an NFL norm of about 42 passes, and the Ravens don't average anywhere near 42 pass plays, but if you're talking about an NFL norm, that's still terrific for tackle play. He did have a false start in the game, like Stanley, so they had very much mirror games on each side. 0.75 was points per play were a little bit lower than Stanley's, but he got a little bit higher adjustment, as I saw it, from what I'll get into in a moment, including 4 highlight blocks. They got him up to the bottom of the B range. So he still ended up being a full grade level lower than Stanley, despite what seemed to be very, very similar days. The difference between the two was basically 4 missed blocks. In the case of Rosengarten, had 5 level 2 blocks, 2 out of 3 on pulls, and 4 separate highlights. And I'm trying to remember if there was a highlight block that I picked out from among his that was the best of which, because I often do that in the article. Rather than try and fish that out now, I'll just send you out to the website. Look at filmstudybaltimore.com and the offensive line article. I don't think there are too many people, and maybe tell me if you're a listener to the podcast who does not generally read the offensive line article. I want to hear what about the offensive line article doesn't do it for you. Okay, because it's intended to be very readable and digestible and of a same format. It's almost done from a boilerplate each time, so you can kind of follow it the same way week after week. If you're looking at film, you can decide, you know, what plays you need to watch and see if I've scored them properly or scored them the way you would. But if the reason why you prefer to have me explain it in podcast form as opposed to the article, I'd like to hear it from you. And you won't be hurting my feelings in so doing. But anyway, Rosengarten, good game, and he's played well for the year. The two of them are having effectively equivalent seasons on the left and right side. And that's, you know, we opened this up talking about how they're both playing well enough that we're not really concerned about those as the primary positions of need going into the next draft. In fact, you know, the Ravens may draft a swing tackle, a guy who can play both guard and tackle. I don't think they need to draft a pure tackle in this next draft.
Yeah, very happy with how Rosengarten's been playing. It's not excellent tackle, but it's pretty decent, pretty decent right tackle. I mean, and you got him at the bottom of the second round. He's very cheap. I don't know if he really has the chops to move onto the left side. But you know, I kind of like him. I think maybe he would be a good left guard. He'd pretty quick, could move around. But ultimately I think his home is right tackle. And, you know, I think they made a good pick there. I was a little, hesitant about it when the pick was made, but, you know, glad they have him. And like you said, I don't think they need to be hunting for tackles in the draft. They've got plenty of other positions to hunt for.
Yeah. And I'll just add the thing that, if you think your tackle would make a good guard, that's really a bad thing. It's like saying your starting pitcher is not doing it and you want to make him a reliever. And that's not the case at all with Rosengarten. Rosengarten is plenty play good at right tackle. And I share the same feeling about you. I haven't seen the indications yet that he'd be able to move to left tackle. It could well come up in an emergency situation at some time over the next, you know, his tour of duty with the Ravens, that he has to play left tackle at some point for emergency purposes. I just sure hope it doesn't. I think he's done a solid job on the right side, and I want to keep him there.
Agreed.
All right. Well, great stuff. Always great to talk about the offensive line. We spent a lot of time on it, but let's talk about some skill position players. Who would you like to talk about first?
All right. Let's talk Flowers real quick. Man, Flowers is a good player. He's shifty in space. He's brought something to the wide receiver position that I'm not sure we've ever had. Very happy that we have him on the team, but I'll just keep it brief. He has got to fix the fumbling issues. He has got to increase. And to me, a lot of times fumbling is an awareness issue, right? Because you have to know what's happening and where you are. And if you know that, you are less likely to fumble. And his fumbles have been killer. I don't like to bang on him for the fumble in the Chiefs championship game. He was just trying to make a play. It was tough. Of course, you don't need to do what he did. You just need to protect the ball. You'll fall in the end zone. Isaiah likely tried to copy that this year. It didn't work either. But man, you got to protect the ball, Zay. And you know, you got to clean up a little bit of the dancing too.
I think it extends further than that. We kind of talked about it briefly in the first show, but Flowers is a deadly receiver on crossing routes and has given the Ravens and Lamar Jackson exactly what they need. The Pro Bowl nomination is going to increase the cost of his fifth-year option, which is a bummer from an organizational standpoint, but it is what it is, and he's still worth that. I think the Ravens will still extend the fifth-year option to him. We'll see how that plays out. It's actually one of the big decisions this offseason is whether or not they do that, but it will put them in a position where they can at least try and negotiate a contract with them for a longer term. And if you're looking for additional positions where the Ravens may decide we can't afford to do that, we need to draft a first round wide receiver, it's on the table. Unfortunately, it is on the table. So Flowers is a, you know, great player, but they may feel like they can't afford him at $30 million a year. And I kind of would understand it if they did. They're going to have to make Lamar happy in the process. So Flowers' hands extends beyond fumbling. The problem with not catching the football cleanly has been an issue, and he's had some drops. He's had one of them was dropped directly into the hands of a opposing defensive back last week that ended up interception. And I don't know what he's got to do to improve there, but it does feel like it's not just the speed skating thing, which is bad, that his arms are out wide trying to corner as a speed skater. Rob Long was saying, you know, if he were, I forget what the other thing he was talking about, like a sprinter holds his arms close to the body and holds the ball close to the body. It's an apt analogy, but because speed skaters need to corner, they need to constantly be working their, you know, they're changing their torque and leverage to the inside constantly, so they can constantly make their set of left turns. I think it's left turns, right? Yeah, it would have to be left turns somewhere around the track, either way you're going. No, it wouldn't. It's left turns. But anyway, they have to be constantly like leaning in and generating torque that'll help them that way. And yeah, they probably have to go out wider, and it's probably a great analogy. It just hurts like hell today to hear that crap.
It does.
But
all right,
I'll move on. Let's talk about DeAndre Hopkins, because he's a guy who hasn't got a lot of love so far on this show. Great veteran presence on this team in terms of doing some things as a blocker that have been positive, being there on the sideline to make some throws. He's like a designated outside the numbers guy pretty much for this team. Doesn't cross the field very much at all to get the football. When he does, he's really trying to get open in a small window to be hit. But it seems like a lot of his play has been basically tiptoeing right on that sideline. Another beautiful example where he called for the call to be overturned, and boy, was he right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Pretty good game. 4 catches, 41 yards. You know, I can't remember the last time Andrews did that. That might have been week 3 or 4 since he had that many catches. I'm just throwing too many strays at Andrews. I actually really like him. I just can't get over the contract. I will say, though, Hopkins had one really bad drop that I think it led to a stalled drive in the beginning, where he was wide. Lamar hit him and he dropped it on the left side there. This team has an interesting way of making each person rotates and they make a mistake, right? Like no one's getting drubbed the whole, even like Falele, right? He's not getting drubbed the whole game. It's just, you'll have this person make a mistake, then that person, then this person, then that person. And, you know, I thought the Hopkins drop was unfortunate, because I didn't think I'd seen that this year. But all in all, a pretty good game from Hopkins. And I like what he's brought to the team. I mean, he's been a great presence. All right, the next person for me is Rashad Bateman. You might say that it's an odd one to call out, but I can't for the life of me understand what's going on with the Bateman train. I think he's a fine receiver. I think that, you know, he had a good season last year. I get that he had the injury this year, but he played 38 snaps, and it might have been 38 of the most invisible snaps I've ever seen. I don't know why they can't scheme a target to him on the first two drives of the game just to get him in, because when you're out there for 38 plays and a ball doesn't come your way, when a ball does come your way, you're not going to be sharp. You're going to drop it. You're going to have issues. Bateman's had those issues in the past. It's like when you're playing baseball and you don't get a ball hit to you, and then all of a sudden one gets hit to you. You're just not mentally prepared. And I just think Bateman's too good of a player for what's happening here. I'm just curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so obviously it's very frustrating. And if Tyler Huntley is going to start for some portion of the remainder of the year for the Ravens, whether that means against the Packers or even for two games here, you know, they might not be meaningful games. The second one might not be anyway. But it's possible that Bateman would take a much larger role because he's the good route runner and be in the X position, taking up that space budget as I talk about it. Huntley's going to have some of his on-time throws go in that direction. And Huntley is a guy who really needs the ball out of his hands quickly. Bateman should be a security blanket along with the tight ends that the Ravens have in terms of getting him the football. And I think it would make sense if that changed. It will reduce who Bateman can be as a receiver to have that happen, meaning they won't be using him down the field on some vertical concepts and whatnot. But frankly, they really haven't thrown very many vertical routes to Bateman at all the whole season. He's got something like 18 catches the whole year or something. I mean, it's ridiculous coming off the year he had. And I'll just say, you know, don't count on the Ravens to deliver you fantasy football stats. They will not do it if they're playing good Ravens football, which for most of the game, they were in this one. I mean, they ran the ball 32 times, only passed at 21, which is a winning formula normally, and that's exactly what they'd like to do to another team to beat them. But, you know, they ended up giving up the scores at the end and didn't get the job done. When the Ravens are dominant, you know, Rashad Bateman is not going to give you an 1,100-yard season or a, 13 touchdowns or anything like that. He's just not that sort of receiver. He will be a guy who Jackson hits some. He's part of the extended play value that Jackson has, but he's never going to be a guy who gets 8 targets a game. And that's going to frustrate a lot of people who are fantasy stats. And I don't know how much BS I had to wade through this offseason about thinking that this was Bateman's breakout year and he's going to finally get, you know, 1,100 yards, and you're not thinking about his targets correctly. They should be way higher. And, you know, it's not a matter of even Bateman's skill. It's a matter of how this offense runs through Lamar Jackson.
And it's just, you know, math. It's simple arithmetic. There's only so much to go around. I've said this before. I am a big fan of trade Bateman this offseason. I love the player. I wish it could work out better. I think that that he has value. I think his contract's valuable. I think he's a valuable player. And I think he could bring back something valuable in return. And I would just rather have the money invested and the resources that he could return. I just rather have that invested in the offensive line or the defensive line. It pains me to say it is nothing against Bateman. It's nothing against Lamar. I just don't think that they utilize him enough to have him on this team. And he's just such a low priority in the list of options. By the time you take out Zay and Henry, there's only a couple targets to go around. And so I just don't see the value for him. And, you know, I don't care about fantasy football. I don't play it. I just love real football. But I feel like he's wasting away a little bit on our roster and could bring us some value where we could get more bang for the buck.
Well, I agree with the notion that Bateman has more value to another team than he does to the Ravens. I think he'd be a better player for another team, even though, you know, Lamar Jackson, he had good synergy last year. Mm-hmm. But he set the all-time record for the Ravens last year in terms of touchdowns as a percentage of targets as a receiver, and also for yards per target as a wide receiver. Those are the two highest figures in Ravens history. That was the time if you wanted to trade Rashad Bateman. They instead extended him.
True.
It's a fabulous deal. And now he's, you know, you'd be selling low. I'd be scared to even think of what another team would offer for Rashad Bateman at this time. I don't think it's anything good. Last year, under the reduced value contract he had, mm-hmm. I think he was worth a first-round draft pick. But mm-hmm. now I don't think that that he carries that kind of value. I think he, you know, you'd be trading him and you might get a three or a four in return. And it just wouldn't be exciting at all coming off this year. So I don't think you can do that. I think you play out the contract. You hope it'll still remain a very cheap contract for Bateman's stay here. It doesn't appear like Bateman's going to be in a position to renegotiate that deal anytime soon. Certainly not coming off this year. Mm-hmm. So at least from that perspective, it's hopefully it doesn't end up being an old maid contract
yep.
that the Ravens are unhappy with. So I think honestly, I think the ship has sailed on trading Bateman, but I think that you also got to look forward to when or if Zay Flowers leaves after the 27 season and Bateman, I think is signed through 29, that you really need to have, you'll really need to have Bateman's presence, and hopefully he'll still be a player like he was last year again.
Yeah.
By then, I'll talk about another receiver who was noticeable by his absence, except for one play, Tez Walker. We mentioned the very first program became the sixth player in Ravens history to have both a reception and a sack career. He didn't pick up a reception in this game, which was the unfortunate point. We need to talk about the offense pot, but he did pick up a sack on the punt, which ended up being an oddity that I talked about in a video. If you want to go see the other players who've done it, because it's some very strange and obscure situations. But Walker, in this game, I don't even know how much he was on the field, but I don't think it was that much because they had Walker played six snaps at wide receiver. Yep. They did go heavy in this game. Wester played two snaps, so you a couple guys there who were not getting utilized. Walker in that Bengals game. At home, the Bengals gave it home, was way downfield a couple of times and missed by Lamar twice. And I, for the life of me, can't figure out why he has had an inactive and basically no targets mm-hmm. since then. It's been very frustrating. They haven't found a way to get him back in the offense. But Lamar massively underthrew him on a deep ball that allowed Dax Hill to come back into the play and pry it free or punch it free. And then he also whistled one over his head from about 30 yards away. That was unfortunate, but open twice down the field and all of a sudden you don't see him again. It's just, he's an important special teams player. So he's active every week. He's active most weeks. Inactive for Wallace, right? In one of these weeks.
Yeah. I don't know how to say this without sounding like a complete idiot, but do the Ravens have too many targets? Are they trying to work it across 10 different guys and it just leaves people cold and out of rhythm with the quarterbacks? Like, it just like having three options at running back, three options at tight end. You've got Zay, Bateman, Tez Walker, Hopkins at receiver. it's just really hard to build chemistry for someone like Tez Walker with Lamar, but you see the flashes, you see the talent. And I almost wonder if, and it, this is going to sound like sacrilege because we haven't had a lot of weapons for pretty much our existence in Baltimore, but I almost wonder, have too many resources been invested in weapons, maybe not enough in some parts of the offensive line or the defense, where it just, there's too many cold players who you know, will go three or four games without even being a part of the game plan. It just, it doesn't make enough sense to me. And I just don't know how to articulate that well enough.
Well, let me try and react to it, because I think what you're saying is, do they need the sort of depth they have at the wide receiver position? And honestly, it might be true at tight end. You could make the point, because they've got, you know, Kolar is a good blocker, but do they need Kolar and one pass catcher as opposed to Kolar and two pass catchers?
Yes.
That would be a legitimate question. Do they need Ricard on a team that otherwise has three tight ends? You know, I think the Ravens DNA kind of says they do want Ricard. So maybe it's one of the other tight ends that has to go. Do they need all the backups they have at wide receiver? Okay. I can point you back to periods in Ravens history and awfully important games where they played a lot of snaps with players who were way behind the line because they didn't have adequate depth at the positions. And go back to the 2008 AFC championship game. I know that's before your memory, and I don't really give a rat's ass. Okay. If you want to really try to learn from the past, you got to do a little bit of homework on this. Go back to 2008 and you'll see Marcus Smith, who never had a career reception for the Ravens, played a humongous amount of snaps in that game. And maybe you can even look it up for us while we're doing it. And I'll talk a little bit about what happened in that game. The Ravens didn't get anything mounted offensively. They didn't have a very tough set of three wide receivers they were playing with in the game. And Marcus Smith eventually was the target on a ball in the end zone. And the closest he ever came to a reception his entire career with the Ravens, he drew a pass interference call that set up the Ravens, I believe their second touchdown, might've been their first touchdown even, but it was one of the two that helped them get back in the game. Then they got a big sack from Suggs, were down 16-14, had a chance to drive the field. Unfortunately, had a penalty that set them back on special teams and weren't able to get the drive going. And Flacco threw the interception to Polamalu that was returned for a touchdown and the lights went out. But Marcus Smith in that game, a guy who never had a reception, played how many snaps? Do you have it there, Matt?
I have it up, but I can't tell. I didn't get to the actual game log.
You don't have the. I'll look it up in the game book then. While you're talking about maybe a rebuttal on this, but I would say, it's not an unreasonable thing. But I think with Walker at least, and also with Wallace, when you look at his usage last year, they had a player who really helped them in terms of depth. And when the Ravens had injuries and they had Flowers missing games, they had a guy who was really useful. You might not like the fact that he wasn't Zay Flowers when he's playing, but he was a valuable run blocker. He was a guy who caught the ball very efficiently last year. He made a number of big plays, but anyway, it would be fair to say that you shouldn't talk about depth in a season where you really haven't needed it in the position in the same way.
I think that's totally fair. And I'm not trying to Monday morning quarterback the roster construction, but we're going into games where we have four defensive linemen active, which I think is criminal. And of the four defensive linemen that are active, one is a 37-year-old John Jenkins coming off the flu. One is a almost 35-year-old Brent Urban, and one is a 32-year-old Josh Tupou. And so again, you can never do it perfectly. I'm not arguing against depth, and I think people may want to kill me for arguing for less pass-catching depth. It's just, I didn't think the defensive line that they had pulled together for this game, I just didn't think that was a winning formula. You know, I don't think the Ojabo roster spot that they had going into this year and having Ojabo on the roster, I just didn't think that was a winning, I didn't think that was a winning move. And I'm really glad that EDC is invested in pass catchers, and I think it's paid off monumentally. But I'm not saying we need half the depth. I'm just saying maybe one or two less players.
Yeah.
You know, do we need to have three tight ends and a fullback, right? Like, I would rather a defensive lineman that can be rotated in and, you know, can alleviate some snaps, because I think it's really been proven that the fresher those guys are, the better they are. And so I'm not talking about a drastic shift, but maybe just a slight shift from what they have.
Yeah. And Kyrus Tonga has been a guy who has done that role for the Patriots, and been a guy who not only can alleviate snaps, he takes a regular snap load on their defensive side, and then also plays fullback. They could do that. And I don't know if this is going to be Ricard's last year. I suspect it may actually be a coaching decision coming next year that may involve changes in the way that if there is a new head coach that they want to run the offense. Mm-hmm. And I guess I would say this. I don't know what part of the coaching staff survives if Harbaugh does not survive. So if Harbaugh is out this year, I think it could be a house cleaning where Orr and Monken are both gone as well, because they're just not his guys. And wherever Harbaugh goes, there's a good chance that Orr and Monken would be welcome there with him. Mm-hmm. I know Monken and him have had their little battles this year, but I think honestly, it's less likely that it definitely be less likely that Monken is retained if Harbaugh goes than if Harbaugh stays. I think the chance of Monken being actually shown the door is actually relatively low. Mm-hmm. But anyway, a new coaching tree, a new coaching diagram here in town may totally change the way the Ravens want to go about things. And they may be able to sell to Steve Bisciotti the notion that it's going to take another year or two to fix this, which I'm not really happy about. I think this team is pretty damn good as it's constructed right now, even with a lot of free agent departures. And they ought to be working towards the draft magic to rebuild with a similar approach to the game. I'm not saying the same players, by the way. It could be a lot of different players. But I'm saying I want them to keep the Ravens' DNA of running the football and being very effective that way. I want them to keep the, a lot of elements from that they've learned through very hard-won experience through the Roman years and through the Monken years and through the Harbaugh years in terms of what's successful about winning football. I want them to keep those elements, and they did a great job of keeping partial offensive DNA so far. Mm-hmm. I hope they don't lose that.
Agreed.
All right. I think, we talked about, I think each of these other players some, so I don't really have anybody else I want to talk about. Do you have another player you want to hit on before we call it quits here? We got a couple questions we need to talk.
Yeah. Let's hit the mailbag.
Okay. Let's do that. I'm going to roll over the mailbag. We got one question from ISG here, which is the first. He says, over the season, has the offense or defense been more responsible for losses? Subsequently, what ratio, if any, of your, in your opinion, would you warrant a leadership change in either group? So I think what he's saying, sorry, ISG, if I have this wrong, this may be a guy whose English is not his first language, and he's using a translation device of something to do this. I may be wrong about that. I apologize for it if that's the case. But I think that's the question he's asking, is what's the chance that there'll be a leadership change at either position? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so two part question. I think I don't know if the offense or defense is more responsible. I think they've done a really good job of going back and forth. I think they've done a really good job of trading blame. It can, even if you look at the Patriots game, right, there's plenty of blame to go around. I also don't think special teams outside of Stout and some of what Loop's done from a kicking perspective have been that impressive. I don't think the kick coverage has been all that impressive, etc. Would it warrant a leadership change in either group? I would say I would rather a change at the top and a full clearing and a new regime than I would, kind of scapegoating one of the coordinators, whether it be Zach or Todd Monken. Again, I'm not trying to crap all over the coaching staff or Harbaugh. I just think it's time for, we've only got an elite Lamar for another year, two, three, right? Then you're going to start to see some degradation. Not that he's not going to be good, but you're going to start to see it. I would like to see a new view, a new way of connecting with the players, a new way of doing things. And I think that's got to start all the way at the top and not at just the coordinator level.
Well, if you're saying that, then I'd say the chance of having the either or Monken leave is pretty damn high if they bring in a new coordinator at the top, and a new head coach rather, because if they, particularly if they bring in a college guy. I mean, he's going to have his guys he's been admiring probably from his own conference, maybe his own staff that he's going to want to bring with him. Like John Harbaugh brought a bunch of people from Michigan and whatnot. Sorry, Jim Harbaugh did. And John Harbaugh also, you know, obviously had the internship for McDonald before he came back to be the defensive coordinator here. It well could be that that guy, you know, comes in from the SEC, say, and then brings a bunch of other coaches from the SEC to go with that. I mean, I would see that as a fairly likely situation. A guy like that may or may not, you know or respect Todd, may or may not respect Monken, which would mean that he may or may not stay. And he's probably going to have no experience with Orr, because as far as I know, Orr's experience has all been at the pro level. I don't think he was a player, and then he moved directly to being a pro linebackers coach. So I don't think he spent any time in college. I may be wrong about that. He may have spent some time somewhere as a college coach. But yeah, I think there's a change in leadership is certainly possible. There's a lot of people calling for it. It comes with risks, and it'll be interesting to see how Bisciotti does it. Here's what I want to see if they change coaches. I'll say this. I want to see an open process at least to the level it was last year. Did a great job of showing us what the process was as season ticket holders in a wonderful book they sent out to us. It's about the size of a game program, but it was all basically about how they made the choice of the next offensive, head coach for the Ravens. And they talked very openly about they offered the job to Garrett and then they offered the job to Harbaugh, and they went through these interviews. They liked them both and yeah, blah, blah, blah kind of thing. But it was very well done in terms of all of the steps they took to satisfy themselves that they had coaches that they could live with. So I want to see that again. Bisciotti being from the hiring business, hopefully he'll be very transparent about that and show it. I think it was a big hit with the season ticket holders. I can only say, Steve, if you're listening, it was an enormous hit with me. And I handed out that book to our senior management team at work to basically tell them, you know, this is how you do good hiring, and this is something I want to see again. So it's something I hope that will be done again for the season ticket holders.
Agreed.
All right, let's go on to another question here. Nick Ringrose, not understanding how or why Henry was not in on the second to last drive. He was beating them up in the second half. Mitchell was unfortunately not effective at all. What could Todd have been thinking? Why didn't John get on the mic and put Henry back in? Do you want to start us off on this?
Yeah, I think we've covered it a little bit. I think they were doing a rotation between the two backs. I think that in hindsight, they probably would have done it differently. At the end, they wanted to get Keaton a few plays, and they were going to rotate Henry in. Ultimately, you know, John said he could have changed it, but it's not always that easy to change it once you've kind of got it going. I don't know. I just think I wish it was done a little bit differently. I've been caught up in bad decisions too. I have a professional job. I've certainly made my fair share of decisions that I wish I had back. It just sucks that this team gave itself absolutely zero grace to make mistakes, because they had made so many mistakes earlier in the season and they've made so many mistakes in this game, right? So you just get to the point where things like this get really magnified. If Zay catches that ball, goes upfield, and by the grace of God, Huntley scores, no one's thinking about this. So, yeah, it sucked. I don't think any of us like what we saw, but I think that's how it happened.
Well, I'm right there with you. And the only thing I didn't like was the way after the fact that the kind of thing is communicated in this third person kind of sense. It's not something where a discussion that happens between Taggart and Henry about using Mitchell to start the drive. First of all, I don't even believe it. But second of all, why would you even mention that as part of the discussion points? Just say, you know, look, ultimately this is my choice. There were plays that we had in mind for Mitchell at that point, which were more suited to him. That would have, I mean, somebody has to answer like that would have been okay. It wouldn't have been necessarily the right answer, and it would have been, you know, proven to be wrong by what happened in the game. We're gonna go ahead and say, but at least it would have been I take responsibility for this answer. And there's the third personing is the first time it's not the first time, but it's something that has bothered me about the communication style specific to the last couple of weeks with Harbaugh about the team. So we'll see how this ends up. In some ways, I'm not sure I could take another year of the constant Harbaugh bashing. I mean, the hyperbolic Falele flashing. I mean, he's not going to be around next year. There's not any danger of that because some team is going to pay him a lot more money than the Ravens are willing to. But the constant bashing is completely unnecessary relative to his relative standing in the league. If you had the Lions guards, sorry, the Dolphins guards, yeah, you take your time knocking the hell out of those piñatas. But Daniel Falele he just doesn't deserve it in the same sense. He's a slightly limited player who they're not paying a lot of money, and you get actually not terrible value relative to his cost.
Yeah.
All right. Got one more question. It's from Prof Boggs. He says, this looks like this addressed to Voss. So I'm going to hold off on this and use this on the Friday morning GM show, but he had an interesting question. And Prof Boggs, I'll be sure to, we include that on Friday morning GM. Matt, always great talking football with you though, when we get the chance. I appreciate it. I hope we get to have you on a lot more shows. I'm sure we do a lot of work in the off season. You'll be on an expectation show, at least one, and you'll probably be on a positional review show of some sort, but tell folks where they can talk football with you online.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at 20 Kid Rock.
Okay, other folks out there, thanks so much for listening in. Merry Christmas to everybody. We this is not the lump of coal we were looking for under the tree, but hopefully you have a great holiday season. Be careful when you're driving out there. There's a lot of idiots on the road, and you don't want to end up being a statistic at this time of year. So, look around at your family and remember just how much they mean to you is the only advice I'd give you. And hopefully that's not going over the top on a show like this. Matt, thanks again for coming on.
All right, Ken.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.